Welcome back to the program. Unlike the protests of today, back in the 60s and 70s, protests had real-life consequences. My guest, Jamal Joseph, lived on the front lines of those battles. He was deeply enmeshed in the ground-shifting, volatile, and violent period that encompassed the anti-Vietnam protests, the rise of the Weathermen, police brutality, the height of the drug war, the murder of George Jackson, the Attica Rebellion, and the revolutionary Black Underground. In an almost Zelig-like way, Jamal Joseph was part of all of it, ultimately landing him in Leavenworth, where he served 12 years. At the same time, he earned 2 degrees and is currently a full professor at Columbia University's School of the Arts Film Program, where he served for 5 years as its chairman. It is my pleasure to welcome Jamal Joseph to talk about his memoir, Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. Jamal Joseph, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, thank you so much for having me.
I was thinking that if I did a long introduction of your life, it would really be recounting the book. It is really a remarkable story. Tell us, first of all, where you grew up.
Well, I grew up in New York City between the Bronx and Harlem. I was conceived in Cuba. My mother and father were grad students at the University of Havana, actually med students. And my mom came home after the semester was over and said that she had gotten pregnant and broken up with the guy. And when my grandparents pressed her a little bit more and found out that my dad was hanging out with revolutionaries like Fidel Castro, before she, I think, could finish the sentence, they had her on the first thing smoking to New York. And although in Cuba she had been, a scholar and spoke Spanish and French, in New York in the early 50s she was a Black woman who couldn't speak English, and so she put me in the care in a foster home of people who became my adoptive grandparents. And they had been, their parents had been slaves. And I grew up hearing stories about a South where they had witnessed lynchings and cross burnings and people that they knew beaten. And you couldn't look a white person in the eye if you were coming down the street. In fact, if it was a narrow sidewalk, and if you were Black, you had to, get into the street. And if it was raining, your shoes just got muddy. But there was also a sense of working really hard. They both worked very hard. Grandma was domestic, and Grandpa was a laborer. And they told stories about Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement, and which they had been part of, and they were part of the NAACP. So I grew up kind of with this rich sense of that part of African American history, and not being ashamed to be, of being African American, but aware of the contradictions that were around. Grandpa died when I was 12 years old. Never knew my dad, so I was an honor student and in the choir and involved in the NAACP. But I hung around the basketball courts and the street corners with the older guys, trying to be cool, trying to be bad, trying to be tough, trying to figure out, what it was to be a man. And I think it was reflective of what was happening in the civil rights movement. There was one part of people, very much believing in Dr. King and nonviolence and doing things the right way. And there was what seemed to us to be this bad, tough element, the militants that was saying, we can't turn the other cheek. It's time to move in the other direction. And then for me as a kid, both what was happening on the street corner at home and at church with the NAACP all exploded and changed on the night that Dr. King was assassinated.
Did you have a sense of yourself becoming politicized during this period, or was it more reactive to what you saw going on around you?
I think it was reactive. I think that because I had, that kind of, family tradition where, civil rights stuff were discussed and, in serious ways, but sometimes in funny ways. A quick story about Grandpa is that he wasn't scholarly in the sense that he would sit down with the book going like, okay, this is who, Benjamin Banneker, the architect and the inventor, was. It would be more like we'd be watching TV, Grandma's black and white TV, and a Tarzan movie would come on, and Johnny Weissmuller would swing and beat his chest, and he would yell, and the elephants would obey, and the tigers and the lions and the monkeys would obey. And Grandpa would be kind of watching that, and he had been a merchant marine, so he could cuss like a sailor. And he'd watch this for a few minutes, and he'd go like, boy, what the heck is that? I mean, what the hell is that? He's a little cracker baby that fell out the plane. He can speak lion, monkey, tiger, every damn thing. The Africans look like they're crazy and scared. Change the damn channel. So it was very lively kind of critique and ongoing. in that way. But it was but I knew something was wrong, and that there was a bigger movement out there, so that it was reactive. And I think for a lot of young people, Dr. King's assassination was reactive, and we just knew we wanted to do more. And that's when I came to school the next day, and I said, I want to be a black militant. And my buddies that I ate lunch with, you know, a group of us always ate lunch at the same table, kind of looked at me. And one of my best friends was a white kid, Paul Kirshner, and he looked at me and he said, Eddie, I don't know if you can announce that you're going to be a black militant like it's a career choice. Like you could be a doctor or a lawyer. And I was like, no, Paul, you watch. So probably as much to prove to Paul as to myself, I had to find the most militant organization out there, and then the Panthers exploded on TV. They did a news report about these militant men who carried guns and law books in California and stormed the state capitol in Sacramento with guns and leather coats, you know, to protest the changes in the laws. And I looked at them, and first reaction was that they were absolutely crazy, and the second reaction was like, I want to be one of them.
Well, there was something romantic about it.
It was absolutely romantic, and they were kind of the epitome of this of the 60s cool and the badness, you know, just really kind of, you know, standing up to the system. So we found out the Panthers had an office in Brooklyn, which was a two-hour subway ride from where we were, and really we weren't really quite sure. Nobody had really – I was the youngest. I was 15 years old, and it was with two friends that were a little bit older. Nobody had really read the Panther newspaper, just knew we just had a flyer and we were going in there. So we surmised that we had to be really tough and really cool, and they would probably send us out on a mission that very day to kill a white dude to prove ourselves. And I'm scared, but I don't want to turn around. I don't want to be a punk. I'm with my older guys. And we get to the meeting, and the office is indeed filled with cool young Panthers with their leather coats and the army fatigue jackets, and the person up front is explaining the Panther 10-point program, which talks about housing and employment and, you know, community control and education, nothing about killing, killing any white people or anything. But I jump up, you know, I'm not really listening, and I said, arm me, choose me, I'll kill a white dude right now. The meeting goes quiet. The person leading the meeting calls me up, and he reaches into the drawer of the desk that he's sitting behind, and I think, oh, boy, here it goes. What am I going to do? He's going to give me this gun. And he hands me a stack of books. And it's the autobiography of Malcolm X. It's Wretched of Earth by Fanon. It's Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. And I'm not sure what to make of it. I think maybe this is a test, you know, to see if I really want to be a Panther. And I said, brother, I thought you were going to arm me. He said, young brother, trust me, I just did arm you. And then right on the spot, he gives me a critique, you know, because the Panthers, you know, were about class struggle and building coalitions. He said, look, if all of these cops that are in the community beating people up and locking them up and shooting people down were black, and the store owners that are ripping people off with these high prices and these inferior products, the spoiled vegetables and the rotten meat, and all of these jive time politicians that are lying and exploiting and oppressing people, if all of them were black and everybody on the other end of this was white, you know, the poor folk and the people being brutalized and ripped off, he said, would that make things correct? And I answered with my brain instead of my, you know, be a man, 15-year-old ego. And I said, no, sir, it seems like we'd still be wrong. He said, that's right. This is class struggle for human rights, not just race struggle. Study those books so you understand what the revolution is about. And consciousness shift that day and the next day working in the Panthers breakfast program and the health clinics about what struggle was and what grassroots organizing really was, and progressive struggle in terms of, you know, organizing people in the community around their needs. And then this coalition building, you know, seeing white people come in the Panther office and Asian people and Latino people to sit and to meet and to get Panther papers and to talk about what was going on in their communities. And I got it. And then just so a week after coming in, a month after coming in, I understood what it was to be a young Panther, and then really had some context for what not only progressive folks in the black community were struggling for, but what progressive people everywhere were struggling for.
Yet there was still the other side. By the time you were 16, you found yourself in Rikers Island.
Well, yeah, because, you know, what was happening is that kind of conversation, you know, students and you know, and workers and black people all coming together talking about changing the government, right, challenging the laws, challenging the economic system, you know, talking, you know, people's revolution, will get you attacked and challenged by the government. So at 16, right after I turned 16, I was arrested The cops did a sweep in New York City one morning. They kicked in Grandma's door at 4 o'clock in the morning and took me off in handcuffs. And I found out that we were part of a case called the Panther 21 case, which was the District Attorney Hogan wanted to arrest the entire leadership in New York and make the organization just go away. And I was the youngest, but I was head of the high school cadres by this time. I was a mm-hmm. pretty good youth organizer. I had learned some stuff in the NAACP and found myself in prison, honor student, choir boy, 16 years old, facing $100,000 bail, which was in 1969 was, you know, $1 million, $2 million, facing 300 plus years in prison.
You got out, you spent about 11, 12 months on Rikers Island. Then you got out. Did it chasten you in any way?
No, it hardened me.
Yeah.
And there were two reasons. I actually, you know, Rikers Island was a very brutal and tough place, and I saw the inhumanity, how young prisoners were being treated and how guys were treating each other. I saw the brutality and, you know, the terrible living conditions, and had to fight to reluctantly get, you know, got into a fight with a bully, with one of the toughest guys there, you know, because he kept just kind of pushing at me, and the guy said, "You got to stand up for yourself. You know, we understand, you know, you're talking all this unity stuff, but this is jail, and you'll get killed." And then I thought I'd had to fight everybody else, but because I had stood up against this bully, everybody came to me and said, "Well, you're kind of like in charge now." And I said, "Well, let's change things. Let's not fight each other, and let's not extort each other with, you know, giving a guy a bag of cookies and demanding five bags back, you know, when they go to commissary. Let's have a cooperative, and let's share, and let's study, and let's teach people how to read and write." And we organized. And so that made me understand, you know, living in conditions that some of the stuff that was maybe a romantic notion when you're talking about, you know, when you're, you know, a young student and you join it, when you're among those conditions, you find out that this is real. And the other thing is that one of the Panthers that I looked up to, that was my section leader, that was like your sergeant, that mentored me when I first came in and taught me the 10-point program and, you know, straightened my head out about, you know, even being a better grandson, being more, you know, not disrespecting my grandmother by staying out way past curfew, even if it was Panther business, actually turned out to be an undercover cop and one of the key witnesses in this Panther 21 case. So I came out hardened and, you know, just wanting to be the best young revolutionary that I could. And I think the other part of it, to be honest, was that heartbreak that someone that I looked up to, not having a father figure mm-hmm. in my heart, turned out to be this, turned out to be a cop who was testifying in a case that I would have gotten hundreds of years for. The Panther 21 was eventually acquitted of all of those charges, in large part because we had great, great young attorneys, a lot of them just out of law school and, you know, wanted to fight in civil rights and political cases. And we fought to get a jury that was more representative, and so really fought hard to have a diverse jury that had a lot of women and a lot of people of color on it. And then we would challenge everything that they said was criminal activity with kind of a political thing, you know. You know, we talked about Dr. King's assassination by the government and Malcolm X and why people would feel the need to organize, you know, and in some cases, guns in their homes for self-defense of people being assassinated like this. We thought we were making our last statements, you know, to the jury and to the press before we got 300 years in prison. But the jury actually listened and found a lot of the charges baseless, and the Panther 21 was acquitted of all charges.
During this period, or shortly after this period, the Panthers started to become more militant for a whole host of reasons.
Well, what was happening in the country to the Black Panther Party, you know, in particular, but around the whole country, was that the government's response to people's movements was becoming more and more violent. So Fred Hampton, for example, was killed in his sleep in Chicago. Panther 21 is arrested in 1969. Fred Hampton is murdered in 1969. The Panther offices around the country are, you know, in Des Moines, Iowa, the office is bombed. In other places, they come in. And a lot of times when the police come in to attack the offices and they raid it, there are no guns. And what they do, they destroy the books that we're using for the Liberation School, which was our after-school and Saturday program. They destroy food from the breakfast program. Panthers are being mysteriously killed. So the Panthers now do start to, in the homes and offices, you know, have night patrols where you stand guard duty because, you know, if you just let the police in, they're killing people. So we're telling them they can't come in and calling lawyers and calling the press and just doing that. Your day-to-day activity as a Panther is the same. It's even more of working in the breakfast program and doing the, you know, the health clinic and organizing, helping tenants organize rent strikes. But the press is covering the arrests and the shootout. So there's this escalating war. And also there is the FBI's counterintelligence program where they, where Panther offices and committees are being heavily infiltrated with cops and with informants and agent provocateurs and, you know, creating a sense of paranoia and fear within the organization that something can happen at every moment. So it's a very tense, fearful attitude, and there's an implosion that also happens within the Panther Party between, you know, East Coast members and West Coast members. So it's a very tense and scary time. But I just want to say that in Mississippi State, for example, students, black students are killed by the local sheriff's department, you know, for protesting on campus. And in Kent State, white students are killed by National Guards for protesting on campus. So we're seeing a very violent government having a very, very violent response to what starts out to be peaceful protests and occupations and rallies across the country. This is America in the late 60s and the early 70s.
And it's easy to forget how violent the country was becoming at that point.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, that's the context of what was happening. People saying the Panthers are becoming more militant. I say the government was becoming more warlike in terms of what it was doing to its civilians that were exercising their constitutional rights to kind of protest and challenge, a system that wasn't working.
And you got caught up in all this and eventually landed yourself in Leavenworth at the time.
I did. I mean, I went back to prison for a combination of things. One was that the Panthers started closing down drug dens in Harlem and the Bronx that were functioning really like open-air markets. There were rows and rows of abandoned buildings that drug dealers turned into drug houses where people could buy drugs and to get high. And there were bodies in alleys and on the street of young addicts who were ODing. I'm talking about young, you know, mm-hmm. boys and girls who were 12, 10, 9 years old. So and the cops were riding by with the blind eye, you know, either because they thought the problem was too big or they didn't care or wasn't within their command venue or, you know, a lot of people on the payoff in those days, talking about a really corrupt police department. So we started going in with guns and taking the drugs by force and then flushing them down the toilet, sometimes just even down the sewer as we gave a speech to the community. But that led to going to prison for weapons charges and assault charges and hiding people out on the FBI. But in Leavenworth became transformative for me because there was a great college program there run by the University of Kansas where you would come in and work really hard to the same or higher standard as any student on the outside. The professors were no joke. They took no quarter. The guys respected, if not feared, their professors. You know, it's funny how you can get more respect from a guy, you know, by marking up his English exam than, you know, challenging to a boxing match. But we had elderly professors who would do just that. You know, you can do better. And it was like, okay, professor, I'm sorry. I'll rewrite the paper. You know, guy, 200 pounds of muscle doing life, you know, trembling in front of a woman in her 60s who has a PhD in English telling him that he could do better. And so I earned two college degrees while I was there and also started a theater program. And originally it was just going to be one play for Black History Month, and then the Latino gang showed up, and at first I thought it was going to be a gang war. And, you know, one of the leaders of the gang watched rehearsal for about 10 minutes and says, "Man, let me speak to you." And I said, "Man, I'm going to get killed for trying to do a play in prison." And he pulls me to the side and he says, "Essay, I had to come check this out for myself. That guy you working with, that guy, Essay, I got to tell you, listen to me." He's not feeling his character. So I said, "Well, why don't you get involved?" They got involved. And then the white guys now get a little nervous because they see, this group of blacks and Mexicans sneaking off. They send their toughest guy, he hangs out with us for about 2 hours. He comes back to his section of the yard. All of his guys surround him, white supremacists, bank robbers, bikers, and they go, "What was going on, man? You went up there, Reb?" And he said, "Yep." He said, "Well, what are they doing? What are they up to?" He said, "A play." "Well, what did you do about it, Reb?" He said, "Well, they give me a part." And we became our own multicultural section of the yard. And guys talked to each other that just used to stare at each other from across the yard. They were doing theater together. And then you would get those same guys to come to class with you and take advantage of the college program. And I, in Leavenworth, in prison, in Kansas, saw what the new weapons of social change and revolution could be. It was arts and it was education. To bring people together to really look at things, look at their lives in a different way and live their lives in a different way.
And ultimately you would wind up spending several years as chair of Columbia University School of the Arts film program.
Yeah, I came out and began working first in community theater and educational films, and then went to Sundance Directing Lab and became a writer and a director and started teaching at Columbia about 14 years ago. And eventually became a chair of the film program where I served for 5 years and a full professor and still on faculty today.
At a university that the Panthers wanted to burn down back in the 60s.
Well, in particular, I gave a speech when I was out on bail in the Panther 21 case. The students had taken over the campus, and they would always open it up to other coalition organizations, so the Young Lords and the Panthers and, progressive Latino groups and, Asian groups were there, and they would give it to the Panthers to kind of close because, they know we would really fire the crowd up. And so I'm speaking as a member of the Panther 21 and a young spokesman, and I'm like, brothers and sisters, if Columbia University doesn't recognize that the war in Vietnam is a war of capitalist exploitation and that the military occupies Vietnam the way the police department occupies Harlem and is trying to occupy this campus, then you must fight, you must rebel, you must do more than take the university over. You must burn this damn place down. And then ironically, I'm walking to class a couple of years ago, and we would always do this in front of the central headquarters of the university, which is Lowe Library, and there's a big, big statue of a bronze statue of mm-hmm. Alma Mater that sits there, and we would always use her as the stage and sometimes blindfold her with, like, liberation colors and all of that. And I'm walking to get to class. I got about 5 minutes, and it's chilly. It's in the winter, and I hear somebody go, "Hey, psst." And I look, and I don't see any of my students, any of my colleagues, and I take another step, and I hear, "Psst, hey." And I look up, and it's the statue. And she looks at me. She says, "Oh, it's Professor Joseph now, is it?" So it's funny the journey that life gives you. But that work has been with my students has been amazing. And I run a youth program in Harlem where we use the creative arts and education to empower kids to tell their stories. And that's what really led to the Oscar nomination, because mm-hmm. the kids got cast as a choir in a movie, August Rush. And we asked the director, and Kristen Sheridan, Jim Sheridan's daughter, could we write a song, a gospel-inspired song? And she said, yeah. She had seen a lot of the shows and loved the spoken word and the music. And we wrote a song called Raise It Up that was nominated for an Academy Award.
Talk a little bit about the young people that you see today on college campuses and their sense of activism, their sense of being politicized, and what you think of it in general, and what role the arts might play in coalescing that.
Well, it's amazing that with all of the access that we have to information, that in a way it's too much information, because we don't know how much activism is happening on campuses across the country and in high schools and in communities. There are a lot of young activists who are inspired by the civil rights movement and the progressive movements of the 60s, inspired by the Panthers, know a lot and want to learn more and want to organize. And we're seeing that in the Occupy movements. We'll see that again as the weather gets a little bit warmer. We're seeing these coalitions of students coming out to protest what's going on. In the 60s, as I look back, it's always amazing how little technology we had and how quickly information travels. Mm-hmm. So that if something was to happen and there was a protest about police brutality in one community, say in Chicago or in San Francisco, there would be rallies, instant rallies in support the very next day. And that was just, you know, kind of by telephone and word of mouth, and the same with college campuses. So I think that we have to first use media and social media to get people into rooms together to talk. One of the great things is that you'd be at one of these rallies and afterwards you wind up in a dorm room or a restaurant or somebody's apartment, and people from the Panthers would be there with people from the women's movement and from the workers' movement and the labor and the Latino mm-hmm. movement and the Asian movement, and you would talk about what you had in common, and you'd bring these things back to your communities to say we are in a national struggle or worldwide struggle. This needs to happen, and that happens by people getting into the room.
Now they're only on Facebook together.
Now they're not only on Facebook, and so activism is more than just clicking and pointing. It really is getting out into the street so that the community and the government and everyone can see the strength of your numbers. The Egyptian revolution, the Facebook revolution that turned into thousands and tens of thousands of people in Tahrir Square, is an example of that. But the other thing that's really important is going into the community and organizing people around their needs. We learned that from the civil rights movement. It's what inspired us with the breakfast program. You know, we knew there was a problem of hunger in the community. So rather than just yell at the system that our people are hungry, the Panthers said, look, our kids are not learning in school, kids in the black community, not because they're disruptive and not because they're not bright, but we have teachers trying to teach arithmetic, saying 3 apples plus 2 apples equal 5 apples, and their stomachs are growling. Let's do something about this. And just by getting donations from stores and, you know, getting space from churches and community centers, we started a national breakfast program that became the model for, you know, food programs, you know, that exist today. Organizers have to get into the community and organize people around their needs. Otherwise, they people in the community would be saying, I don't understand all these percentages. You were talking about the 1%, and I see these students and these young people talking about, what's that got to do with me? Organizers and grassroots organizers from the 60s on, from the labor movement on, understand you get into the community and you get people involved, first of all, in their own kind of, you know, situations. They become participants in these programs, and then that makes the conversation real to them, and it makes it, you know, through communities. It gets people to lock up and link up and struggle together. So that's the two things I really say to these really brave and brilliant young activists is you've got to get out on the street together, get in rooms together, and then take shifts, even if you're doing a 24-hour Occupy where you're in communities, like doing soup kitchens, feeding people, tutoring kids, health clinics, all of those things so that the people understand you're organizing, that you're from these communities, you care about them, and that you're organizing and teaching on their behalf.
Jamal Joseph, the book is Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention. Jamal, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It was great to be here. As my young people in New York say, keep a positive thought, because a positive thought will not be denied.
Jamal Joseph, thank you so much.